the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
As technologies and geopolitics change, so does the nature of warfare. Welcome back to On Future War, a series sponsored by Cubic Defense that looks at emerging technologies and how they may affect peer and near-peer level conflict in the future, particularly in the Indo-Pacific region, with a specific focus on military tactics, operations, and strategy, and their interaction with the other instruments of national security policy. The future is now. This is Authentic.
All right, welcome back. We're on episode two. This episode, we're going to be talking about unsinkable carriers. That's the Chinese man-made island bases, specifically in the South China Sea. I'm an Air Force guy, so I don't know much about the ocean, but I know who does, which is my co-host today, Roger. So welcome, Roger. And I hear you brought a friend that knows even more than us about this.
I did indeed. Everyone, you've heard him before on the Fighter Pilot podcast, and Flounder and I have done some work together on the Gaza situation. Matt Flounder Arney. Flounder, introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to come on the show here. Yeah, I come from a Tomcat and Super Hornet background as a Rio turned Wizzo. Also spent some time driving aircraft carriers, operated in the South China Sea during my command tour a few years ago. But yeah, this is a really great topic. A lot of fascinating stuff has happened over the last decade, so I think it's going to be a great conversation.
Yeah, me too. I just want to jump right into it. If people, you know, we kind of joke, we go, oh, they're the unsinkable carriers. Like, we're not talking about aircraft carriers this episode. We're talking about islands. So building islands out of the ocean. It's an interesting strategy. We'll see how it plays out for China. So what we want to talk about in this episode, just to scope everyone right away, is what are we actually talking about? How are they actually made? Where they're at? How useful are they? And how sustainable are they? And then there's some strategy and tactics that go in with that. So we'll talk about kind of capabilities, vulnerabilities, and there's a little bit of a backstory of how this whole thing got kicked off. It didn't just happen overnight, like bam, there's islands, and then there's territorial disputes. Flounder, do you want to start with the backstory of where the whole thing came from, or you want me to kick it off with like the nine dash line and kind of go from there?
Yeah, if you know the nine dash line, 11 dash line came out of, I think it was the late 40s during actually Chiang Kai-shek's reign, and then it was picked up by the PRC under Mao Zedong, and so that's when it went from 11 to a 9-dash line, which was a concession with the Vietnamese there. And so that's been withstanding for a while. It was basically China's claim to the South China Sea. If you look at the South China Sea and draw a ring around all those internal shores on the South China Sea, it was basically China saying that, you know, this is our area. And there were historical claims that go back thousands of years, just like all the nations in that area can have those kinds of claims. And that's been a lot of the conflict there, is the overlapping claims in those areas.
Yeah, interestingly, Vietnam is actually one of the lead people going after the same disputed territory. So not a man-made island, but the other islands that's just north of the Spratlys that we're talking about today is the Paracels, which is a Chinese tourist destination, apparently. But that's another territorial dispute. I was doing some research about that, and I saw that in the, I think it was in the 80s or 90s, they started building fuel reserves and ports and the Paracels for cruise terminals, and they actually still do cruises out there, but that was one of their, you know, inhabit the island, and now you can kind of, you know, put your flag there. It's a really, yeah, like you said, it goes back a long, long, long time. The more recent stuff kind of started happening in the 80s, there was the dispute with in the 70s over the Paracels, and then in the 80s, Vietnam and China kind of started going back and forth over the Spratly Islands. And for and Flounder, you can correct me here, but it's roughly 14-ish things above water and hundreds of reefs and shoals and things just below the surface. And so the value is not the islands itself, but the things that are just below the surface that you could build on.
Yeah, that's right. Just from the, you know, what can I build on out there? If you're going to build in the ocean, then you want something that's close to the surface that you can build on, if that's your goal. But also, of course, there's just the aspect of the natural resources out there. There are oil reserves, there's natural gas. The fisheries is a big thing when you get into, you know, the territorial waters are 12 miles, but then you get into exclusive economic zones and all the competing for fisheries, which is a really big industry out there, especially with seafood consumption amongst all those Asians, as well as opportunities to export. So there's a lot of economic reasons why a nation's going to want to claim. And if they have an island out there, then that just means that they can have an exclusive economic zone that is inclusive of that island and the area around it. So it just expands those opportunities if it's not being contested.
That's a good point, Flounder. So you actually mentioned like two or three things that we're gonna jump into. The EEZ that you talked about, like that actually accelerated this issue, even though it was not the intent of why that happened. But we're gonna get into the resources and the policies and the lawfare that's in play. I don't want to jump forward too fast. Let's talk about before what was the so we know what they are. Let's talk about how they actually make them. So they're just below the surface. The Spratly Islands are something like 800 miles off the coast of China and are about halfway east-west between Vietnam and the Philippines, for those of you who don't have a map and you're trying to picture it in your head. So very, very far from China, closer to the Philippines and Vietnam. So China comes out there and they say, we're gonna build islands. This seems like a good spot. And if I remember right, in the 90s and early 2000s, they were doing the surveys assessing like the limestone and the tidal flows back and forth for a few years. And they said, hey, this, and this, there's a few that they picked. These are the big ones. We can build on this. And then they were like off to the races. So can you talk to like how they actually like built it once they figured out which ones they want to build on?
Yeah, certainly. They've got some large dredging ships out there. And, you know, that's the big thing. It's like you said, you survey, you figure out where you want to build, and then you put these dredging ships out there, and they're going to scrape up the bottom and just combine the material that they're getting from the bottom and just dump it onto where they're trying to build that island out. Just volumes of material that these ships can spew per hour to just start whittling away at, well, the opposite of whittling away, slowly build up that. You know, if you're starting with something that's under the surface of the water, then you're going to start just building that up. And then once you get above the surface, you just keep dredging to do that. And we see those kinds of, you know, dredging activities in beaches as we try to reclaim different areas. We've seen that in the Emirates with them building the big Palm Island area and stuff like that. But the amount that they were able to do over a short period of time, a relatively short period of time, was pretty interesting. So then once you get that all that material in there, you got to pack it down. You got to maybe build seawalls around it to fortify it, to make sure you fortify it against erosion. You're going to reinforce maybe areas of it. So all kinds of things that, depending on what construction engineers believe, need to be done to make sure that what you build is going to be able to stay there. Because you're out, like you said, hundreds of miles out there in the open ocean, a lot of weather affecting. So that construction process, you're spending all this time, money, manpower, then you want to make sure that you put all those reinforcements in place to kind of hold back Mother Nature on the erosion. And then once you get that foundation built, now you can start building other infrastructure on top of that.
And have you seen, so you referenced the Palm Island, there's also the globe that the UAE had built out there. Have you seen it recently?
Let's see, it's been probably a decade since I've seen it, but yeah.
If you go to like Google Maps or some of the other things, they have like go back in time. And so if you go back probably 20 years when they, or 15 years ago when they built it, that's probably 20 years now. It's, I mean, you can see it from space. It's awesome. This thing is awesome. And then you look at what it looks like now. Not so awesome. Because it's weathered away, right? They didn't have, they built it. It looked really great, but it's very fine. I want to say it's like silicon-based sand. So it's very compressible and it moves around a lot. Where the sand that we're talking about in the South China Sea is actually mostly like from organisms and coral. So it's very rough. It's very compressed. And it's not going to just wither away. And to your point, the islands that China built has like fortifying like concrete walls. I mean, they built these things to stay. They didn't just dump some sand and like put up a flag. The bigger islands, I want to say there's three of them that have 10,000 foot runways. Mm-hmm. That's like landing a space shuttle type runway. Like these are not puddle jumper runways. They're for bombers and fighters. And then we can get into the other stuff that they have on there down the road here in the episode. But just for context, China built not one, not two, but like lots of these islands in a very, very, very short amount of time. I want to say it was about 2 years from like 2014 to 2016. They went from, hey, they're building islands, to like, oh, there's an island. Oh, there's another island. And there's another island. And then there was a legal dispute that went to one of the UN governing bodies because they were trying to execute a play out of it was a sovereign territory claim. And you can fill in the rest of the blanks here, Flounder, since you lived this area and you were floating in the area. So
no, you're right. I mean, there was that sovereignty claim with the UN and things, and you know, I'm certainly no expert in there. Like I said, I've operated there. It's a fascination of mine. And so I'm sure that there's details that I'll miss, but the general context is, you know, over the last 10, 12 years, they've built up, and I had to do a little research before this myself in the Spratly Islands. So there's seven man-made islands out of those, and three of them are, like you said, are extensive, and it's not just the runway, it's all the other stuff. The Paracels, there's 20 islands, and like three of them are extensive as well, with, you know, Woody Island having a runway. There's 72 hangars on the Spratly, on the three islands in the Spratlys, and 16 on Woody Island. So they're significant island structures. And so certainly with the interesting you brought up, the surveying and those things, and also the tourism that they were trying to play to in the 80s and 90s, you know, that kind of backdrop, because having operated through the 90s, 2000s into the 2010s, it really did seem like it was a sudden thing. It's like it snuck up on us, even though there was extensive planning and work that was going into them.
Yeah, the Middle East distraction was real. Yet another example where we're not paying very close attention. Someone was, you know, someone somewhere was watching that, but not really the people that needed to be paying attention. So going back to the why it matters, why build these runways? We start with the tourist one and the Paracels up to the north. You have the territorial claims in the south. So one of the, when I was looking at this too, because I didn't want to come to this, you know, podcast unprepared to talk about this, right? I didn't realize the exclusive economic zone was actually kind of a somewhat recent thing. Like it really wasn't a thing, and then it was, and then it's like, oh, well, we can maybe, how can we take advantage of this? So it actually goes back to 1982. So before 1982, there was no such thing as the EEZs. And what this is, so you have your United States, for instance, and then out to about 12 nautical miles off the shore is your territorial waters. So the United States has 100% claim to all that. Don't go in there. And then out to 200 nautical miles, they have the exclusive rights to all the economic benefits. So fisheries and natural resources and drilling, natural gas, rare earth metals, all that stuff. Well, the problem is when they instituted that law is that you know, if you look at where the South China Sea is and you go 200 miles off of everyone's coast, they all overlap. And they overlap right in the middle of the South China Sea, where turns out that's where the Spratly Islands are. The only one that doesn't overlap is China. But we already talked about the nine dash line. It's within the nine dash line. And so that's their angle that they've been trying to work. So if anything, the Philippines and Vietnam actually have a stronger case for a territorial claim. And this is why the Philippines, if you guys watch the news lately, there's a, I'm laughing, this is not a funny thing. There's a very old ship, I think it was from World War II, from the, I think it was a US ship, that they, the Philippines, I think it was the Navy, purposely have run it to ground just east of the Spratly Islands. And they have an outpost that they rotate people on this ship. That's like, it's not a seaworthy ship. They just run it aground. And it's to keep the Chinese from building on those islands for the territorial claim. So you, every time there's a resupply, this gets into our logistics a little bit later. Every time there's a resupply, the Philippine Coast Guard comes out to bring supplies. The Chinese try to intercept, and this is where you see those videos online where they try to ram ships. So they have these close calls. They're trying to interfere with their sustainability of keeping that, you know, 20 people on this like rotting carcass of a ship that's grounded on a coral. Like, you know, good on those guys for doing what they can with the resources they have to stake their, you know, territorial claims. It's a really fascinating and really sad thing to see play out, honestly.
Yeah.
But yeah. The economic exclusion zone, or I'm sorry, the exclusive economic zone. I always say it backwards. There are, I looked this up. There's $2.5 trillion of natural resources in the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So those claims matter.
That's right.
And it's busy, right? There's like, I'm going to say it's like one of the busiest transits of the world, commerce, like floating commerce. So you're like $5 trillion of global trade pass through the South China Sea. They go around India, up into the, you know, the ports of China off the East Coast. So it's, there's a lot of ships, there's a lot of resources, there's a lot of things in play. It's a very, very, very important.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the, of course, what was it, 90% of the world's trade goes over the oceans, and 2/3 of that, I think, goes through the Strait of Malacca, which feeds right into the southern end of the South China Sea. So you're getting all that trade coming through there. And so, you know, that is one thing. We mentioned the oil, the natural gas, the fisheries, all those kinds of things. And then kind of what you were alluding to is, if you're going to take a claim out there and you've got other entities, because thinking about the EEZ, you know, off the Pacific Ocean for the U.S., it's easy. 200 miles out, it's easy. And then you go up to the Aleutian Islands, okay? So those islands keep extending our EEZ out there. Again, very clean, because we just deal with Canada. And there are actually a few territorial disputes that we have with Canada, but we handle them in a much nicer manner than what we see China doing.
Is that the one, the island where they just keep changing the flag and they leave a bottle? Or am I thinking of Northern England?
Yeah, I don't know. There's one I was read about in The Economist a while ago that just surprised me that, you know, and there are states that have, you know, these things. So anyway, but if you look at the if you're going to be competing in the South China Sea, then having these islands out there, not only do you, if nobody contests it, if you built an island and nobody contested it, then it kind of becomes that fence between neighbors, that you build a fence 2 feet into your neighbor's property, and over time it becomes yours. So if nobody contests it, then, you know, pretty soon you're just going to claim it's yours. But here it's contested, and so one of the things these islands allows the Chinese to do is they have patrol craft and other things stationed out in these islands that can go out and do the harassing of that you alluded to, the harassing of the fish, the Filipino fishermen, of the Vietnamese fishermen, and stuff like that, to make it just more challenging for those others to actually do what they're going out there to do in the South China Sea. There's also the harassment on the radios, where the Chinese, you know, the PLAN, the naval forces, go out there and they, you know, claim that people are operating in Chinese waters and stuff like that. So it just allows them to bring that harassment right there to the front lines of the South China Sea as well, amongst a lot of other stuff we'll get into.
Yeah, a big part of Turns out a big part of competition is showing up. And then if you want to execute either rights to something or to preserve access to the global commons, you have to stay there. And the only way to stay there is to be land-based, right? I'm telling two sailors to say the land matters. that fact's not lost on me. but just to double tap on how big of a deal this is for people who aren't tracking. So when China built these islands in a matter of like 2 years, and you know, like bureaucracy takes a long time to sort things out. When you get to like the United Nations, that takes forever. No one ever makes a decision. Like within 6 months of them going, these are our islands, in 2016, the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, the UNCLAS, basically all these nations came together and said, no, that is not legal. So there was they got a instant backlash. I think there's actually 8 nations that sided with China and everyone else sided against them. But that was when we talk about the legal dispute, it goes back to 2016. And then China was like, well, I don't agree with you. I'm just going to keep doing it. So there's this weird unresolved resolution that kind of happened. Everyone said it's bad and it's wrong, but the actual change of behavior never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that is actually one of the more concerning parts, is that you have a UN governing body that said, no, this is wrong. And they said, well, you're interpreting the law wrong. We're going to do it anyways. And because there's no, to my knowledge, there's been no repercussions of that. That's like, well, I'm just going to keep doing it.
Yeah, I mean, think about what kind of repercussions there could be. You know, and it's when China says they're not going to agree and they're just going to keep doing what they're doing, there's not like there's an international police force that's going to come in and give them a ticket. And, you know, so we're going to still have those diplomatic conversations that happen. But in the meantime, we're still going to have the bullying behavior on the playground that they're going to still assert their claims. And because, you know, there was, I think you mentioned earlier, the 80s or the 90s when the Chinese and Vietnamese came to blows? I think the Chinese sank 3 ships of the Vietnamese Navy, killed about 70 some of their sailors. And I don't think anybody wants something like that to happen on all the sides. But people are going to still look to cross the line where they can and test those boundaries. But it's going to be the professionalism out there of the various forces that keeps something from rapidly escalating. But there's no doubt that there's smoke there. There's a spark that we could get into that pretty easily.
Yeah, I'd say probably worth mentioning under the UNCLOS, freedom of navigation ops. So we talked about when the UN says you can't do that, and China says, well, I'm going to do it anyway. You know, that's not unique in world history. That's happened before. And there is, there's two competing concepts here. One is that if no one does anything about it, after a certain amount of time, everyone sort of throws their hands up and goes, okay, I guess you own them. So to use that bully on the playground analogy, if the bully says, these monkey bars are mine and no one tries to get on the monkey bars, eventually the principal, if you will, goes, yeah, well, those are the bully's monkey bars. And to flounder your point about the professionalism that needs to be displayed, the 7th Fleet, U.S., Far East Naval Command, fairly routinely conducts on or freedom of navigation ops, which under the UN law says that if it's contested, you can drive your ships through there as a statement that you do not concur with that. And so it's important to remember that that is ongoing and it needs to continue to happen, or the Chinese get this legal precedent by default of that territory being theirs.
Yeah, and notably, Roger, that you typically see with the U.S., but there's other of our allies who do FON ops as well. And that's an important thing when it comes to trying to uphold the UN's decision. We do it in practice with these FON ops and with the other nations out there doing FON ops as well, to say that no, we believe that we can freely navigate here, both on the surface and in the air.
Yeah, and it turns out The status quo is derived from the status. So if you don't do anything, that becomes the status quo. If you do something, that becomes a status quo. So the FONOPS, you're trying to establish a status quo. You're desensitizing that, hey, this is a routine thing. It's non-escalatory. It's written here in the law. Like procedurally, there's nothing we're doing wrong. You're wrong. And then when you have these encounters and these disputes over these the territorial disputes, but all the stuff we've been talking about, this is where I think it's fascinating. In the past 5 years, and really a bit before in aviation, but typically the past 5 years, with the advent of those, like, you know, broadband and cameras and social media, you can go on Twitter and look at these Chinese ship incursions against, like, the Philippine Coast Guard, and you can see in real time, like, all of this stuff happening in near real time. And so I think the power of you know, publicity is a good way to kind of keep the global conscious kind of in check. If the people see it and say, well, that's okay, well then maybe that is the status quo then. And then, so there is a messaging campaign that goes along with that of saying, like, hey, this isn't right. So there's a lot of things about, like, exposing those types of things, right? Like, so when China does something that's in secret sometimes and it's bad, and we said, hey, people should know about this, you know, they disclose, you know, intel sources disclose these things are happening because they're trying to shed light on something to get world opinion, at least not an opinion, but at least awareness, and then you can actually get them behind your back. And again, it's about changing the status quo. So it's an interesting time right now, because FONOPS is coordinated with IO campaigns, and it's all planned, and even the time of day, the routes, the, you know, what day of the week, what month, and all of those. And same thing with aircraft, when they fly aircraft through these zones as well. There's been some interesting, there was the fighter that tried to rejoin on a B-52 and almost ran into it about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago from this recording. Good targeting pod video. That was really good.
Yeah, and certainly we have installed, you know, in the Navy, in our, and I think also in some of the large Air Force aircraft, because I know it saw this jumping around the world when I was in Sweden at the embassy there, and we had ships operating and airplanes operating in the Baltic Sea. We saw the same kind of behaviors out of Russia. And so it became the norm that, you know, until we get cameras installed on these aircraft that can capture the bad behaviors, you know, let's make sure that we're capturing them with handheld devices, whether it's on the bridge of a ship or in an airplane. And so, and since then, we've basically installed cameras just for that IO campaign, like you're saying, get the message out there to the international community that you can see clearly on video that this is bad behavior. And we see that in the South China Sea.
All right. So we've been talking a lot about these islands, why they're important, how they're, you know, the 10-foot tall and bulletproof. Let's talk about some of the drawbacks of having a man-made island in the middle of the South China Sea, hundreds of miles away from anything.
Yeah.
Well,
there's a tail.
Where do you want to start? I mean, they're, I mean, I think we answered the question with the statement, right?
Yeah. They don't have natural resources available to them, right? To feed their population. You could do reverse osmosis desalination, but it creates one of the more difficult supply chains known to man, which is contested logistics delivery over water. So that's the primary drawback.
Remember I talked about the Philippine stranded boat outpost, mm-hmm. That's just east of that. Yeah. Well, it's just a, you know, rotting carcass of a ship, right? With some supplies. And so they call them rotation and resupply missions, ROR missions. And so once a month, the Philippine Coast Guard brings out new supplies to rotate people off the little, the ship. But these islands, remember we were talking about earlier, these are not small islands. They built them for a very specific military purpose. And you can look at the satellite imagery. They have these massive underground storage tanks of fuel and water and oil. And so they have a sustainability perspective from that regard. Some of these islands have, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people that are permanent residents, or a rotational presence, I guess you could say, with, you know, 100, 200 shipping containers of supplies. So they, you know, they may be full of MREs and might not taste good, but at least they can stay there for a while if they have to. So, but yeah. And that's kind of, I initially was like, wow, you know, you could blockade and starve them out, you know, do that kind of a thing, like a exhaustion strategy, but maybe not.
No, I don't know. I think if you're looking at peacetime or not using the island for as a military base, they can stay there for a while. But we've seen in Ukraine, I anticipate we may likely see in the Middle East very shortly, profligate use of weapons, far higher than estimates. And, you know, you go through fuel for your aircraft and your ships very quickly. So it becomes a question of how useful can they, how long can they remain useful as a tactical base?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, first of all, it's the peacetime aspect of just logistics, like we were talking about, the fuel, the food, the water, the, I'm sure they don't care too much about wastewater. They probably just dump it right into the ocean. But, you know, all these elements that are just keeping people alive. So you've got the ones with airstrips, but interestingly, if you look at the overhead shots of these, the harbors are, you know, and a lot of these are really nicely done, very protective harbors that they can bring ships in. But as you said earlier, it's a few hundred miles. So it's an extensive operation just to keep these things going in peacetime. And then you have weather events and things like that that are going to make it challenging. But then when it's contested, you know, the two sides of it from the Chinese perspective, how are we going to keep the logistics going during this while it's contested? How much stockpiling are they going to have? And I mean, as you guys were talking, I'm thinking about Midway and Kwajalein and, you know, all these Pacific islands that we were hopping around and maintaining forces on. And so it's definitely doable. And so I don't want to, I just want to say that I don't want to make it sound easy that we'd be able to, you know, we would be able to overcome this challenge, because from the perspective of somebody trying to make sure they don't lose out in that area in a conflict, it's a significant cost barrier to us, whether it's a hell of a lot of weapons or, you know, a hell of a lot of blood to go in and take down these formidable fortresses out there that have, you know, naval guns, they've got AAA, they've got anti-ship missiles on land-based anti-ship missiles on some of these, plus bomber aircraft that can launch out of these places. So, I mean, it's a significant, they've built up a significant presence to push out that ability. You know, how long, 20 years ago, they were constricted to the shores of the eastern shores of China. And now they've pushed that way out there. And it is a significant hurdle that anybody's going to have to get through.
Yeah, to say the other difference from 20 years ago is China has been building a blue water navy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there, I'm sure we will later in the series argue about quality of the Chinese blue water navy, but quantity has a quality all its own. And you need enough hulls to protect those sea lanes of communication or SLOCs, and to have presence around those islands. And when you think about the relative sizes of the Chinese Navy and the U.S. Navy, even if you throw in our allies and then realize we have worldwide commitments, and the Chinese basically, I'm oversimplifying, but have a South China Sea commitment, the calculus very quickly also swings in favor of Chinese defense of those SLOCs to the islands.
Yeah, when I've heard as not a Navy guy on this episode, I'm going to go ahead and weigh in with a Navy opinion. So that's my alibi up front.
All good.
So, yeah, I see a lot of back and forth where people start counting like hull productions from China versus the U.S. and like the big bad, you know, big bad China. And like, well, it's not, they're not combat capable ships. They're not, they don't have war fighting hulls. They're just building more ships. I'm like, well, here's the deal. Like, they're not building them to fight. They're building them to establish a status quo. And so if you can have a blue water Navy in a competitive environment, you can build a ship for a tenth of the price, because it's not going to go to combat, and you can float it around in the South China Sea, right? So that's their own FONOP campaign through the presence and the logistics sustainment of the islands in the South China Sea. So that's my take on it. Like, even though they're not maybe warfighting ships as a per se, like we think of it, it's definitely part of the competitive landscape.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's a whole other episode, just digging into the their Navy and where it's going. And you know, the other part of this context is, are we talking about fighting tonight? Or are we talking about fighting 20, 50 years from now? Because hopefully, you know, when we're recording this, we just had Xi Jinping and President Biden met recently. Hopefully we can keep those things going. I don't think anybody wants to, you know, go to blows. Mutually assured economic destruction of U.S. and China going to blows is pretty horrific.
We have a deterrence like strategy, though. So peace through strength, mm-hmm. right? Pray for peace, prepare for war. Deterrence is the best way to preserve the peace in an enduring manner. Like, it's kind of all makes sense. I mean, we can hold both of those. We can prepare for conflict as a deterrence mechanism while advocating for peaceful relations, right?
That's right. And so, like we were saying earlier, if something happens that, you know, some incident at sea or in the air and things escalate quickly and get out of control, I mean, we could easily see a path to. So we need to be prepared to be able to fight. But kind of going back to our conversation about where these islands fit into that, is that that it would just be, you know, it's a different context than it was 15 years ago. And so it plays heavily into the home field advantage that they have versus the away game that we have to play.
Yeah, speaking of that, when so besides the Navy, the economic or the exclusion economic zone and the systems, and we talked about these being like fortresses. So let's talk about that for a second. So in the past 15 years, the ability for weapon systems to reach out and touch people is has grown exponentially. It's almost comical of how long range some of these systems are now. Now, I used to joke, well, not joke, you know, I used to try to give context. Like, if you take the Red Flag at Nellis Air Force Base, which is like one of the largest air ranges in the world, you can do an air-to-air war, you know, came out of Vietnam, yada, yada, yada. Well, Vietnam only had like SA-2s. There was only, you know, a handful of them. And so when you look at surface-to-air missiles, you can take the most capable surface-to-air missile system in the world that China has, so the HQ-9 or CSA-9, however you want to say it, and you can put it in the middle of the range and it would take up every single square inch of the airspace. Mm-hmm. One system, that's all it takes. And that thing, it has 250-mile range. It's shooting, you know, like very high-speed missiles, like average Mach 4, and they fly some interesting profiles that go a little bit faster than that, depending on what they're doing. But yeah, they're going to reach out and get you. And then you have, and that's just the air platforms for ships. They have the YJ-12, which is basically the same thing. It's like a Mach 4 anti-ship missile with a 250-mile range. These are systems. This is not like looking it up on Jane's. These are systems that are right now today deployed on these man-made islands. Mm-hmm. So when you look at like a layered defense, it starts at about 250 miles. And remember, what I say, like the nearest piece of land is about 200, 250 miles away. So these things can really reach out and touch you. And then it's layered in. So it's not just if you make it through that, you'll survive or run them out of, you know, munitions. There's multiple layers of their defenses to include. You have your short range air defenses, your short rads, whether it's like a bullet, it's like a automated cannons, or like out of spectrum, whether it's IR or RF. Missiles of all different types, all different spectrums, all different speeds. So it's definitely, you know, if something were to happen and something sparked off, it'd be interesting how we would go about picking that apart without being too destructive to the point where it could actually be escalatory. Mm. Whether you target the fuel stores or you target the limited communication things they have, because again, they're very far away. There's not like a landline, so they're using like HF radio and you know, sat phones, or you target the generators, right? Because they have little power plants there that are pretty well known. So it'd be an interesting discussion of how you would try to de-escalate that without, you know, taking out or just flattening the whole island. Because I mean, that's a possibility, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to do that, though.
We sort of talked about that in episode one, right? On the flip side of that, with places like Guam, and you know, what do we look at? It's interesting for me to think of our perspective as a defender, saying, "Oh, look at all these vulnerabilities we have," and now we're talking about attacking these islands, and it feels so much more challenging than, for some reason, than the Chinese challenge of attacking ours. But so, I have two things that I want to ask Flounder or Paco.
Give it to Flounder.
I'll give it to Flounder. Okay. Right. Okay. So, you know, hypersonics, right? Where I don't think either side is there yet, but will hypersonics change all that calculus? You know, the U.S. Navy has 60 years now of guided surface to air missile experience, R&D, and everything else. And the question becomes, and you know, the Chinese have almost as much, and depending on how you look at it, that you can say that the sort of Soviet / Chinese axis might even have more robust air defense network concepts than we do. They've definitely been defending against air attack more than we have. Do hypersonics throw all that out the window? Is, you know, my first question.
I don't think they throw it out the window, because with every advancement, we figure out tactics and countermeasures and things like that. It might just take a little time as we work on those things, but it certainly gets thrown in the calculus, you know, and we've kind of kept this Navy focused. I've been wanting to bring in the Air Force, the Army, Marine Corps into this conversation. And you just look at all the different entities that we have permanently stationed in the area or deployed to the area, in Japan and Korea and with Philippines and et cetera, access to different places. And, you know, the combination of these islands and the threats that Paco talked about, and now adding hypersonics, as those will get fielded over the years. You know, all those things just continue to, again, 50 years ago, we were talking about the Chinese shoreline, the east coast of China, but all that stuff gets pushed out and the ranges of the weapons get pushed out. The time for those weapons to travel gets much less. And so the decision process, it's got to be a lot more quick and has to be agile. And we have to properly equip our forces over there so that they can be protected from these threats, and they can not only be protected defensively, but be able to have offensive capability to neutralize these threats as well.
Wander, I'm glad you mentioned the Air Force. Thank you. But I'm gonna go a little bit off here. I was talking about the Army, which is like the last service you would think of that it would have a play in this, for a whole bunch of reasons. And we'll talk. The Marines, yes, we'll talk about that as a parting shot for next episode. But the Army, so. This is the one case that I see where the Army in the Pacific, they have the long range hypersonic weapon. It's called the Dark Eagle. It uses a common glide vehicle from the Navy and Army, but the launcher is Army specific. And then the Navy has their own launcher specific. This is a 1700 mile Mach 17 weapon. And it's going to field, it was supposed to field this month. It'll field probably in next quarter, so probably January, February of 2024, depending on when people are listening to this. And this is like the reason why you want something like that, because it can go very, very far, very, very fast. And so you don't have to actually deploy forces that far to get close enough. And then your response time, Mach 17 So Mach 1 is 10 miles a minute. So Mach 10 is 100 miles a minute, right? Am I doing my math right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's 170 miles a minute is how fast it averages, according to public records, right? Mm. So it's going 1,700 miles. It's, what is that, 10-minute flight time, something like that?
Yeah, it's not red. That's
insane. It's so fast that, I mean, if you launch it from, say, 500 miles away, it's like, well, you have like a... From flash to bang, that's like, you know, 2.5 or 3 minutes. Like, that's the decision time. If that's like a, you know, fate, your, you know, opening salvo of like, all right, we're going to do this, let's just do it. and target, you know, these key facilities on these islands and just negate all of their capability off the bat. That could be actually de-escalatory, because we actually can show in 3 minutes, we actually can hold all of your islands at risk. And so it's not worth actually putting up a fight.
Yeah.
And so that's where I see the army hypersonic, that particular army weapon, having a huge play in the Pacific, because it could be de-escalatory, even though they're going to be like, you know, $15 or $20 million a missile. That's actually a lot cheaper than deploying a whole force to fight over some islands when you don't need to.
And right? Cheaper than an F-35 or an F-18 or something like that.
Shoot down one aircraft, it pays for itself.
But that's great. And there's deterrence in that. If we can field them, have them in Korea or, you know, wherever we're going to put them over there, that's great deterrence. But if I look at some of these, like Woody Island or was it Subi, and some of these that are, I mean, they are significant. Like one of them, you can fit the entire territory of Washington, D.C. in the harbor of this island. I mean, this is the size that we're talking about. And then the infrastructure and the hangars and all that kind of stuff. So how many of these?
They're definitely not austere as you think of when you think of like, oh, it's just a man-made island in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
There's one of them that has not a tennis court, a series of tennis courts. Like it's a whole like sports complex. Like these are big bases.
Obviously, the Chinese Air Force hadn't gotten there because they would be a golf course. But anyway. But the cost of taking, you know, of how many hypersonics does it take to quote?
There's your
take
cold
out?
Open.
Yeah.
I'm still laughing.
Yeah. But how many hypersonics does it take? It again goes back to raising the cost of deterrence and raising the cost of actions to punish, you know, on a tit for tat. Or if it comes to full blows, you know, what's the cost in hypersonics and other munitions to neutralize this outer layer of this defense in depth that they built?
And I think that's a great point to make about where the future of this series is going to go. Is we're going to talk about all these different things and all these different capabilities. Is the hypersonic weapon, you know, a one or two weapon strike that leverages an opportunity, much like we think about electronic warfare getting no longer dominating an airspace per se, but dominating a moment or a window of time. You know, can the hypersonics be used to build a window of vulnerability to other weapons? And then the other thing is, you know, I want to come back to Paco's comment about de-escalation here, which is, in a way, these islands play to everyone's favor because they're not home islands. They're not home territory. And I, you know, like you said, there's thousands of people on some of these islands. I don't take the loss of life lightly when I say this. But you could strike an island like that and so have a sober moment for all the players and think, maybe this is the pause we need to step back from what's about to happen.
Oh, that's right. And a great analogy for that is the Korean Peninsula. And I can't remember the name of the island. South Korea has an island that's off the coast. It's within range of North Korean weapons. And this island only has like a military outpost. So it's isolated from the mainland and it has no civilians. It's like auto winter, right? So North Korea can attack this island without being escalatory, but South Korea can't actually counter because North Korea doesn't have like an island with soldiers sitting on it that they can attack. And so it becomes this like one way pressure point. And they haven't done it in a while, but you can go back and look that they've had these periodic attacks that they'll attack this island when they get mad. And then South Korea can't respond in kind because there's no mechanism to respond in kind too. So it's the same thing it's like China attacking Guam with some exceptions. Obviously Guam has a lot of civilians on it too, but it's a U.S. territory that's everyone knows that. And it's completely isolated from mainland, you know, U.S. It's so far away that it couldn't be perceived as attacking, you know, the homeland of the United States. Where if you try to attack something like that's not in the South China Sea, that's, you know, part of China, Those they do have a lot of islands, but they're like, you know, 10 miles off the coast, 20 miles off the coast. Like, that's pretty
attacking
close.
Hainan Island would have a much more emotional response.
Yes.
Maybe emotional is the wrong word. Impactful response.
So maybe the worst thing that they're doing right now, I mean, I'm not trying to give them answers here. Maybe the worst thing they could do is keep that pure military. Like, it would be really complicated if you turn it into a dual use and brought civilians there and advertise it. You know, we have a cruise terminal down here in the Spratly Islands, and like, ugh, that would get really ugly, I think, because it would take away a lot of options off the table that may be perceived as pretty clean and neat.
Not a clear-cut target, and I don't think there's a downside to the Chinese.
China, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. That's a bad idea. But, I mean... there's no downside to the Chinese, because far more than we in the West, in the United States, there's such an integration of Chinese military and civil industry that, you know, you were talking about up in the Parcells, the resorts. And of course, I just think of Aeroflot, right, back in the day. Like, sure, it's the national airline, but we all know that, you know, Spetsnaz guys can be jumping out of those things when they need them. Anything that's got bunkerage for cruise ships is bunkerage for warships. Mm-hmm. You know, anything that's got support services for the 747s for Air China is air support for any number of military aircraft.
Well, you're just ending on doom and gloom. I don't want to end on doom and gloom. Flyner, give us some good news.
Well, okay. So I'll give you two things. I'll give you two things I've been thinking of. One is when we talked about some kind of retaliatory strike in some measure, it got me back to thinking about the Pacific Island campaign again. If we look at this from the U.S. perspective or the Allied perspective, you know, whatever that alliance would end up being in a situation, how much destroying do you want to do of these islands? Because then do you want to use them as a foothold as you start, you know, laying claim to the South China Sea militarily? So that's one element that I'm sure goes into planning. And then the other thing I wanted to get to is the durability of these islands. There are a lot of things out there that we're seeing that even though these islands are only 10, 12 years old, that there's a lot of falling apart. There's a lot of erosion that despite whatever effort was done for surveying and planning and construction, that they probably cut a lot of corners. And so... you know, what is the durability of these islands as we look 10, 20 years down the road? And what would it take for China to say, okay, well, we didn't quite do things as well as we could have on some of these, so let's go in there and rebuild to make sure we fortify them, versus I seriously doubt they're going to let them just crumble in back into, be reclaimed by Mother Nature again.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like the Emiratis could afford to lose that because it was kind of I'll just put some sand here. It's really cool looking for, you know, a little bit. But yeah, the interesting is once you build something on top of it, like you have to, like you built a runway, and if the island is sinking in like the middle of the runway, do you just like scrap the whole runway, just bring in more fill dirt and then put another runway on top of it?
Yeah, I mean, there's the erosion coming from the sides, you know, it's as the sides crumble. And if you don't have seawalls all around, or if you didn't really reinforce your seawalls and that kind of element. But yeah, if internally it's sinking, plus, you know, that brings up the other thing, it's relative, because then you got sea level rise. So as we look, you know, we all like to say, we only look past to the next election cycle, like, oh, the Chinese look 50, 100 years down the road. Okay, that's a little bit of dramatization, but if you are looking 50 to 100 years down the road, you know, what's sea level rise going to do to these things, as well as all the other effects of Mother Nature? So there's a lot to unpack there and prognosticate about.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem long term. I don't think when they went from like start to finish in 2 years, they were thinking about the long term.
No.
I think they were building it for a purpose to like, and they're, yeah, there's definitely, if you have a playbook you'd like to share with us, it'd be great to figure out what your plans are. But the runway is an interesting thing. Most people don't realize, like, if you spend enough time in like aviation, and you see the different types of airfields that you go to, like I have a Strike Eagle background. So it's a fighter, But it can be a pretty heavy fighter. So fully loaded, an F-15E can taxi and take off at like 80,000 pounds, and it's 80,000 pounds on, you know, three tires. Mm-hmm. And so the pressure point when you taxi, there's areas when you look at like ratings of concrete and runways. If you actually like taxi, even though you're on the, you know, the ramp or an apron of an airfield, if you taxi on the wrong areas, it actually like dents in the apron. So when you're talking about building these 10,000 foot runways for bombers, I don't know how sustainable that, you know, that might be good for a couple takeoffs, but it's not like you're going to be operating out of it for, you know, a generation.
Yeah. Yeah. We see that with our airfield. You know, I was the base commander at Whidbey Island, and that airfield was, it's about 80 years old now, and it's certainly not the same runways, but the runways there, the infrastructure there is not new. It's 50 years old or whatever it is. But not only is it the annual maintenance, you know, during the summer season in the Pacific Northwest to dig up sections of the runway we need to replace, but there's also, you know, we've got plans for over the next 10, 15 years to do some really substantial redo of some of those surfaces because of that wear and tear. And like you said, some of the aircraft might be limited because they're heavy and they just can't, they don't have access to the entire ramp. And you do that on reclaimed land in the middle of the South China Sea. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's one thing to think about how long the island's going to be around, but the runway and all those other things, you know, that's a much shorter duration without some extensive rework.
Flounder, could you imagine being the base commander of like one of these islands?
Yeah, Woody Island.
Yeah.
Oh. No thanks. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's see. We've covered. What are we missing? I think we talked about, you know, what they are, how they got there, a little bit of backstory, why it's important. We talked about how they're fortresses that are impenetrable. Then we talked about how they're going to crumble and fall apart. We talked about escalation, de-escalation, deterrence. We had some policy and politics in there for diplomacy. We even talked technology with tactics and hypersonics. What are we missing?
I think we covered
it. Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
There, I mean, we could talk forever about all these, you know, the nuances going, of this.
Yeah.
But while we're talking about islands, and you mentioned the island hopping campaign, a couple of references back to World War II, I think that's a good segue for our next episode, which is going to be talking about the Marine Corps and how the Marine Corps is rapidly transforming themselves into a force to persist and operate in the first island chain in the Pacific. So that is going to be the fight of the littorals, which is the Marine Corps pivot. That's Force Design 2030. And Roger and I are going to be back in episode 3 with maybe a surprise guest. We'll see. And I'll talk about that because I am not the expert in that. And Roger is a huge history buff, though. So he's going to bring some knowledge bombs. I know it.
I'll bring some there. And, you know, we're recording this right after the Marine Corps' birthday. So, yeah. I mean, like any good Navy man, right? We recognize that happy birthday from Daddy, Marine Corps, you know.
Yeah. Jesus. I like the meme that goes around, happy birthday from your favorite Uber driver.
The only thing we didn't, hey, here's my alibi for you listeners out there. I didn't say anything bad about any of the other services. The only service that they haven't talked about bad yet was the Army. So,
yeah. Well, we need to get a Marine on here so that they can, you know, maybe rightfully so, point out that we may have a history of landing them places and then running away.
Yeah.
But, you know, in all fairness.
Well, all right, Roger, you want to do the outro?
Absolutely. So, well, first off, of course, Flounder, thanks for joining us. And we're going to have you back in some future episodes. Paco, always a pleasure. And, you know, look forward to talking to everyone next time on the Littoral Combat Regiment episode. Talk to everyone
awesome.
Soon.
Thanks. Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Flounder. I appreciate it. That was fun.
Yeah, it was. Thanks a lot, guys.
If you've enjoyed this program, you can find additional commentary,
interviews, and in-depth series on current affairs and military aviation at Authentic Media on YouTube or on your podcast provider of choice. On Future War is brought to you through partnership with Cubic Defense. For over 50 years, Cubic has been facilitating warfighter readiness to prevail on night one and beyond.